From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll learn about a project that hopes to answer some of the difficult ethical quandaries posed by big data collection.
You might have heard stories about researchers looking at large data sets of Twitter data or looking at Instagram photos and trying to guess whether or not someone is gay or straight. And there's all kinds of interesting ethical implications of how researchers are using this public data, and we're trying to understand that better.
Then, a look at some of the best areas for home buying in the Milwaukee area.
We'll get a preview of the Cine Latino Hispanic Film Festival starting tonight.
If you took high school Spanish, right, which I think probably 40 to 50% of America might have, come out and see these movies, because this is also a way for you to brush up.
And how bassist Anthony Russell came to combine traditional European Jewish music with African American spirituals.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Yesterday, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before lawmakers in the first of two congressional hearings on Facebook's privacy and data sharing.
The hearing was spurred by the company's data privacy scandal. Tens of millions of users had their data exposed to Cambridge Analytica, a data mining firm affiliated with the Trump campaign and other right-wing political campaigns. But the questions of how big data is being used and who has access to that information has been an issue on the minds of digital ethicists for quite a while.
Michael Zimmer is the director of the Center for Information Policy Research, and he's been grappling with these questions in his work on a project called Pervade. Pervade, or Pervasive Data Ethics for Computational Research, is a four-year project studying a variety of ethical issues surrounding big data. Dr. Zimmer sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last fall to talk about the project and what they hope to learn from this research.
Pervade is a project of a collaboration of six different universities. We're trying to look at the ethical implications of what big data research. You might have heard stories about researchers looking at large data sets of Twitter data or looking at Instagram photos and trying to guess whether or not someone is gay or straight. And there's all kinds of interesting ethical implications of how researchers are using this public data, and we're trying to understand that better.
So when we're talking about big data, what all is included inside of that term?
Well, almost anything. A lot of times we think about social media data, so all my Facebook posts or the photos I put on Facebook or in Twitter or on Instagram. But it's also transactional data. It could be from banks or insurance companies. It could be data from fitness trackers or your iPhone. So really one of the key goals of the big data movement is to try to use as much data as possible to help make decisions and predict things about the world.
So when I was looking at some of the information about Pervade, one of the terms that comes up a lot is stakeholders and the idea of the different people involved in these interactions. So who are the stakeholders?
Yeah, one of the big things we're focusing on is trying to have a much broader approach to understanding the ethical implications. A lot of researchers, even like myself, have spent time just examining the ethics. But what we're trying to do with this project is involve the researchers, the actual subjects whose data is being used, the ethical review boards at universities that might be doing this, the companies whose data is being used, and even policymakers and government agencies who might be trying to regulate this. So we're trying to bring everyone to the table so we can come up with the real usable solutions in this domain.
So when we're talking about regulators, that's a term that kept coming up that I went – that seems so oddly specific and yet also broad. So when we look at people who are regulating how data is being used, generally who are those people?
There's probably two different ways to look at it. In terms of university researchers that engage in a lot of this work, we have ethical review boards on our campuses who do some regulation to make sure we're getting consent and we're protecting subject privacy and those kinds of concerns. But there's also increasing use of this data by companies. So Facebook might use data to test different things on their platform. So then you might see someone like the FTC getting involved on whether or not they're protecting users' privacy, whether or not they're keeping their promises that they have in their privacy policies.
And when we talk about users, of course, users are you and I, anyone whose data might be used for anything. Right now, when we look at how big data is used, Do we have any guarantees as to how it can be used and how it can't be used right now? Like if let's use Facebook as an example.
That's one of the real struggles that we have is that oftentimes the terms of service that we agree to give companies pretty much an open book in terms of what they might use of that data. Typically, it's for good reasons. They're just testing a different color on the interface or a different way of presenting a photo, and they just want to see how different users react to it. But then there could be, you know, more pernicious examples. You may have heard of the Facebook emotional contagion case from a few years ago where they were adjusting people's news feeds on whether it had happy news feeds or sad news feeds and seeing how that affected people's mood. And there are some interesting scientific reasons for that study, but these are the kinds of things we want to make sure that users really understand. And it's not just buried in the terms of service that something like this could happen to them.
Well, that in and of itself seems a little, one might say, unethical.
Right.
You're leading a number of sub-projects.
Correct.
What are those focused on?
We're looking at a couple of different aspects. Two of the projects that I'm going to be most involved in, one is looking at researchers themselves. So one of the challenges in this area is that a lot of the research are being done by computer scientists or data scientists who don't have a long tradition of addressing ethical issues in their work. They're not used to working with humans. They're used to working with data. But now we're seeing a much closer connection between humans and their data. So one of the things I'll be doing is trying to talk with and interview and survey researchers in this domain to get a sense of how do they feel about the ethical implications? What kind of training have they had? What kind of steps might they be taking to deal with these challenges? Another project I'm going to look at is actually how we share data. And one of the big mandates across universities and even government is having open data sets. And what does it mean that if we're going to start sharing data, if that data might have personal information in it, or whether or not users understand that data used for one piece of research might be shared and used for someone else's research. So we just want to try to get a sense of what's going on in that area.
I would actually like to take a step back because, of course, we use this term data so frequently, and it does seem to be a specific word and yet also a very broad word. So when you're talking about data, when we're talking about the things that we're sharing, what does that include? Because I think a lot of people hear the term data and they go, it's a kind of amorphous blob of a term.
Yeah, data has tended to include everything now, which means it almost doesn't count for anything. So we're actually using the term pervasive data. And what we mean by that is not just a single data set or a piece of data that happened to be collected. So my car is parked out on the street right now, and that's a piece of data that maybe the city of Milwaukee might be able to collect. But pervasive data is the fact that, you know, through technology, my car might be constantly tracked and there might be a GPS trail on my phone for everywhere my car goes every day, all day long, no matter who's driving. And that's where we're trying to get more in touch with this, what we're calling pervasiveness, because there's data being collected all the time, all around us, and we often don't even know that it's happening. So we're very interested in social media data, increasingly interested in fitness data because we're wearing fitness trackers, even the kind of data that's being collected in our homes through our smart devices. So it's just really how data and fine amounts of data are being collected in all aspects of our life now that we're trying to uncover.
What are examples of the ethical obligations that researchers have, but that maybe even the companies themselves and the platforms have?
In the most classic sense, we have ethical obligations to not harming, you know, customers or our research subjects, trying to do good for society and make sure that that we're doing positive things. And those guide research ethics overall, whether you're doing medical research or psychological research or behavioral research. We're trying to expand that and making sure that companies understand that the users of these platforms aren't just, you know, data subjects, that they are human beings and they have a right to dignity or a right to control over their information, and trying to sort of broaden out what these ethical obligations are. We're not trying to stop research from happening, certainly. We understand the value of the research that's being done. But again, making sure we have the right kind of frameworks in place so there aren't going to be any accidents or any kind of harm that's done intentionally or not.
When do you hope to start seeing, I don't know if results is the right word, but start seeing some, what did I write before? Results.
Yeah, these things take time. I mean, many of us have already started this kind of work and we have things in progress. We'll probably start seeing the results from our first phase of research coming out next spring or next summer. And this is a four-year project, and we've laid out a pretty ambitious plan for what we're trying to accomplish. And it's going to include both academic outputs, but also guidance for researchers. We're hoping to have some meetings where we bring people together and even create some new kinds of best practices, maybe even, you know, some kind of a manifesto of big data ethics.
All right. Well, Michael Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Michael Zimmer is an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee. He's also director of the Center for Information Policy Research, which is partnering with five other research institutions for the Pervade project. There's more information about the research initiative at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then take a look at some of the best neighborhoods for home buying right now. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Buying a new home can be stressful. There are a million things to consider, but the biggest component is almost always the neighborhood.
This month, Milwaukee Magazine's cover story featured a list of neighborhoods to fit every budget in areas throughout and around the city. Christine Hansen is the author of the article, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about some of the overarching elements of the areas where people are looking to buy.
People are looking for community. They like a neighborhood where they can walk to have a beer or go out to eat or walk to a farmer's market. That community aspect is really important, especially when you're living in a city as large as Milwaukee or metro area as large as Milwaukee. People really want that.
So you go through a number of different neighborhoods and kind of the criteria. Can you first just explain like what each kind of category of home is?
Sure. So in developing this article, we first looked at numbers and statistics. So we worked with Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors and worked with them to figure out, you know, where are the values climbing? So if you're trying to sell, what's a good area to live in? Also, if you're trying to buy, where are the listing prices still low? Because obviously in this article, we're speaking to buyers and sellers who are on opposite sides of the spectrum, right? So we first looked at that and then used that data to really flesh out these communities and what makes them special, whether it's, you know, a local farmer's market or really cute bungalows, you know, whatever. So we started from that place so that we're not just saying, these are the 10 hot neighborhoods. We wanted to really look at facts and statistics.
And the numbers behind it.
And the numbers behind it, exactly. Because at the end of the day, I think, you know, that is part of the process in buying or selling a house. The numbers are important. We can't deny that.
For sure. I've heard actually right now it's really a seller's market.
Absolutely.
So if you're someone who is looking to buy your first home, if you're really just starting out in either, you know, central Milwaukee or one of the surrounding areas, where should you be looking at?
Well, I think the most important thing right now is if you're a potential buyer, be ready to put in an offer. So you need to be pre-approved for a loan and for what amount. Houses are going really fast because it is a seller's market right now. So that's sort of a tangential answer to your question. But as far as where you should be looking, I think, you know, people need to look beyond the house and look at the community. What are the people like who live there? What are some of the local amenities? And that's what I try to do with the story by interviewing realtors who specialize in these areas. It's not just about your house. It's beyond those four walls. What are you literally walking into when you purchase one of these houses? What's the community like? What's the neighborhood like?
So some of the ones that you mentioned in the piece were West Milwaukee, Brown Deer, Cudahy as kind of starting out places.
Mm-hmm.
What makes these neighborhoods good for people who are just purchasing their new home?
Sure. Well, the bottom line is that the asking prices are still very low because anybody who's starting out, unless you're independently wealthy or you have a trust fund to tap into, you probably are working with a limited amount of money. So that's our definition of starting out. But of course, there are exceptions. So those communities have really good, very low asking prices, but also are, let me just say, like, Brown Deer, the realtor I talked to, Katie, talked about how that's sort of a gateway into the North Shore. When you look at the North Shore region of Milwaukee, you can easily spend $500,000 on a house. So this is a way to kind of tap into a lot of those regional amenities, whether it's shopping or parks or schools or whatnot. And same with Cudahy. That South Shore area from Bayview on down to South Milwaukee is really becoming more and more desirable. And this is a way to access that community.
We're downtown right now, of
right.
course, and there are a lot of people who are interested in that kind of city feel. I mean, we are in Milwaukee. It is a city.
Mm-hmm.
If you're someone who is starting out, are there areas in the city that you can be looking at?
That's a great question. I was really pleased to see that Milwaukee as a city is very popular with people. If you travel around the country or even just, you know, take a cursory look, a lot of downtowns have become ghost towns. It's, you know, very popular to live downtown. The neighborhood that we focused on in terms of downtown living, although technically it's a few miles out, is the Walker's Point neighborhood. And I was personally surprised by that. I live in the Bayview neighborhood and travel through that neighborhood often, either on bicycle, bus, car, foot, or whatever. I was very surprised to see how popular that neighborhood's coming because I knew that from an entertainment perspective, you've got sort of our Restaurant Row on South 2nd Street and the Clock Shadow Creamery, a Purple Door ice cream. You know, there's a lot going on there, a brewery as well and a distillery. But people want to live there, too. And that's sort of a recycling back to what was happening 20, 30 years ago. And in the story, I interviewed Deborah Bramer, who is exactly in that position. She once lived there, and now she is getting ready to transition out of her Shorewood home and return to the neighborhood as an adult, as an empty nester.
You mentioned you live in Bayview.
Yes.
And to me, of course, Bayview seems like not the central city, but it does seem, you know, like the city. And that was a neighborhood you mentioned for downsizing if you're someone who's looking to get into a slightly smaller home.
Exactly. In the story, we have a really cool interview with a realtor who downsized with her husband. They were living in Whitefish Bay. They had a 3,700 square foot house, which for some people would be considered very large. And they downsized to a 1,500 square foot bungalow in Bayview. And that's a great story about, you know, someone who still wants to have a house and a yard and a community, maybe doesn't want a condo, but wants a smaller footprint.
So why is Bayview a good spot for downsizing? Just the housing stock?
The houses are smaller if you look at Bayview versus the entire metro area. As a general rule, obviously it's going to vary per house and per lot. But the footprints are smaller. It's still a great place for people. Say they're empty nesters. They don't need a 4 or 5 bedroom house. 2, 3, 4 bedrooms are fine. But they still want to walk to the theater. They still, whether it's Avalon Theater or Alchemist Theater, and they still want to walk to a trendy restaurant. It's a great walking community for people of any age.
So let's look at kind of the opposite of that spectrum. If you're someone who's maybe in an area like Bayview, you have a smaller footprint at the moment, but you are looking to get a larger home, a growing family, where should you be looking?
Well, what I was really surprised to learn in researching this story is that it's a great time to build. And I think when we think about building custom homes, they're usually large. Obviously, the tiny home movement is picking up speed. But for the most part, if you're looking for a bigger house, you're going to build. And in my story, I interviewed a couple people who said, now is a really good time because if you're selling your house, it's a seller's market. So say you're selling an existing house in the city, it will go fast. So you're not going to be stuck with two mortgages. The interest rates are still pretty low. So if you're going to take out a loan for your new custom-built property, this is a good time. I also learned in researching the story that Walworth County, based on the experts I talked to, project that that's going to be the next hot spot because it's really close to, you know, Foxconn will be arriving in Mount Pleasant, which is projected to bring a lot of jobs and people from outside the area. That Walworth County has a lot of open land because that's the challenge. Like if you want to build a custom build in Bayview, well, there's probably 5 lots available. So good luck. But you kind of have to go in these rural areas. So that was a surprising thing that I learned in researching this story.
That surprises me. I'm from Walworth County.
Yes, yes. Well, the reason is its proximity to a lot of areas. Because if you're, especially you have adult kids or you have family in different areas, you can still access them within an hour. A lot of, you know, yeah. Whether it's Madison or Lake Geneva, or Racine, Kenosha, or Milwaukee counties.
Oh, I'm from Lake Geneva. Yeah, you can get
exactly.
You can get to Chicago in about an hour and a half in Milwaukee
exactly.
in about an hour.
Right, yeah. Right.
What are some of the more unusual areas, I mean, that you highlighted in this piece? I mean, you just mentioned, of course, Walworth County, and I believe Burlington is still in Walworth County.
Right. So we did talk about Burlington as one of our South communities because the article separated by geographic area. And so while some people might think, wow, that's really far away, it's not. And again, because of the Foxconn development, there's projections that that will change as well a lot of the community amenities. Because anytime you have a big company come in, you need to have places for them to eat and shop and play. So that was surprising that, and right now the median single family price in that community is just under $200,000. So that's pretty affordable.
What is your biggest piece of advice to people who are looking for a home, no matter what the area, no matter what the budget, what should be the first priority in choosing a new place?
I think that what I learned in writing this story is that the realtor relationship is still very important. We live in a time right now where we kind of think we can do everything ourselves online without any interference or middleman or middlewoman or middle person, right? But what I learned in interviewing the realtors for this story is that they have so much advice and knowledge about an area. For example, Germantown, the realtor I spoke to who's sold in that area for about 30 years, was able to say that, you know, this is a community where I've noticed, based on my client interactions, that people who grew up here are also buying here. So you've got these multi-generational aspects. And that's really important when you look at the health and vibrancy of cities and communities, that you have people who have an investment, who've been there for many years. So looking for a realtor who really knows the area is important, that it's not just another business deal. Another part of the story, we look at architecturally significant areas. I interviewed a realtor on the North Shore, Lori Folk, who specializes in mid-century modern. So if you're a person who, like, I have to have mid-century modern, I don't care if it's in Cudahy or Mequon, I need it, I want it, she's a really good resource. So that's what I learned, too, is that the realtor relationship is very important. You can definitely do a lot of work ahead of time by looking at listings online and photos and such, but really rely on those people because they know.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today, Christine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Christine Hansen is a local writer whose piece on Milwaukee's housing market was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
Coming up next, we'll learn about the second year of Cine Latino Hispanic Film Festival. It's taking place at the South Shore Cinema. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Streets, our house was our castle, and our something tells you that you've got to get away from it.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee's film festivals cover a lot of cinematic ground, from the full slate of films of all genres at the Milwaukee Film Festival to Milwaukee Shorts to the very specific Festival of Films in French run by the French department at UWM. There seems to be a festival for every film taste during a calendar year.
Starting tonight, the second annual Cine Latino Hispanic Film Festival gets underway. The kickoff event is at the Bistroplex at Southridge, and the remainder of the festival takes place at the South Shore Cinema in Oak Creek.
And And South Shore is where you can also see a large mural painted by one of my next guests, the nationally acclaimed mural artist Mauricio Ramirez. He and Nancy Hernandez join me in the studio now to talk more about the art and the festival.
So this is the second year of Cine Latino. Last year, its inaugural year, went very, very well. Lots of families, lots of date nights coming out to see these films in a variety of different formats. So sometimes it was, you know, Spanish films with English subtitles, sometimes all Spanish, sometimes English with Spanish subtitles. But it really let folks across generations and different language abilities embrace movies in a different way.
Do you think there's a moment in American culture in general where various subcultures within the general American culture are finding a place for their culture? It seems like there's black film festivals and there's Latin festivals, gay lesbian festivals, all kinds of different things where people are allowed to celebrate their culture but also offer it to the greater culture at large.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head, Bonnie. I mean, this is a festival not just for Hispanics. And that's certainly not what we saw in the first year and not what we're expecting to see in the second year. You know, you've got things like Black Panther, which not just drew a huge African-American audience, but audiences all across the board that were interested in action films, that loved the Marvel series and what they were doing and wanted to see this and embraced it. You saw it like things with Hidden Figures. And certainly some of the films that are part of this lineup fit that genre as well. And we want to see more folks, regardless of culture and background, to come out and enjoy these films, really for their artistic value, for the fact that everybody loves a good belly laugh, for the fact that everybody wants to have that emotional touch point with what's going on the screen. And, you know, it's an entertainment value regardless of what culture you come from.
Right. And it also gives you an opportunity, if you're not of a Hispanic culture, where you can actually experience it in a way that you might not otherwise. Someone like me coming down to it, I speak a little Spanish, but I certainly didn't grow up in any Hispanic culture in this country. So for me, it's a way to come down and say, oh, that's what's happening here. And both the universal and the specific.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I was sharing with a group of friends of mine. I'm like, listen, if you took high school Spanish, right, which I think probably 40 to 50% of America might have, come out and see these movies, because this is also a way for you to brush up what's going on, not just have a really good entertainment experience, but follow along in a different way and refresh some of those skills that you have.
Mauricio, you have a very special role in this particular festival this year in that you designed the poster for it. And I have it in front of me. And of course, we're on radio, so it's very hard to describe it. But is that an abstract of Frida Kahlo?
Yeah, for sure. It's my own interpretation of it. So, you know, as a Latino artist, you know, I think in the past, you know, we've all been basically trying to, you know, recreate images that, you know, fairly resemble exactly what it's supposed to. And so I wanted to update, you know, some of the painting styles that people kind of walk past every day and stuff. And I wanted to update it and make it give it a little bit more contemporary approach and stuff. So, you know, in terms of the poster art, I wanted something to be a little bit different and just have a little bit cooler design palette and stuff and be a little bit more captivating with the geometric shapes.
The colors are fabulous. It's rich with oranges and purples and grays and some reds in there. And it kind of harkens to the folk art that I think most of us here think of, particularly Mexican art, as being just bright and colorful and folk art and sort of self-taught. But, you know, this actually takes it so much beyond that.
For sure. As an artist today, we're given access to tools that they're able to help us develop, you know, new styles and stuff. So, you know, contemporary paintings today, you know, consist of like tape, spray paint and like stuff like that. And so I just kind of wanted to see what a painting like that would look like in 2018. And I was very honored to contribute that type of work to the Cine Latino Film Festival.
Were you painting in New Mexico?
I was. Specifically Albuquerque.
Talk about a color palette.
Yeah, I mean, for real. I mean, when you really do talk about color palettes, I'd honestly say that, you know, weather dictates a lot of stuff that I end up painting and stuff. So,
how did you two connect? How did you connect to the Cine Latino Festival to actually get to do this poster?
Well, I was aware of Mauricio certainly from some of the work that he has done, even here in Milwaukee. You know, he's got a very strong presence nationally. He's very well followed on social media. You know, I'm one of the followers.
Oh, thanks, Nancy.
But he also did a fantastic Selena mural, which also got national recognition right here in Milwaukee South Side. The city of Milwaukee also worked with him to develop some of the artwork along Wisconsin Avenue on the
utility boxes.
Yeah, the utility boxes.
Oh,
so if you've seen those are fantastic. I didn't realize that was yours.
Those are great.
So he's made his mark certainly here in Milwaukee and nationally. And when we were looking at who's going to best depict this year's festival poster, he was top on our list.
Do you want to stay here? Or do you have other places you want to go and practice your art?
No. Right now I'm traveling for work. Currently on tour with Miller Coors and working with some of the projects with them and stuff around the country and stuff. So, you know, the next couple of months I'm going to be traveling between Chicago, Milwaukee, Austin, Dallas and stuff. So I think being a mural artist, you know, you kind of subtract the indoor studio and your studio becomes the outdoors. And that's basically where I found myself today and stuff. So I definitely do like Milwaukee. I think it has an enormous potential to really be an art destination just because of some of the industrial corridors that are kind of vacant and kind of provide, you know, canvases for mural art and stuff. I think it's a huge opportunity.
I love the idea of modern murals, because that was something that was done in Europe for centuries. It was a big deal, and it was as important as canvas painting. And now it seems to, you know, maybe be finding its new home, you know, or a new appreciation, maybe is the better way to put it.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a lot of good to take away from public art just because of the sheer impact that it has when people walk past it or drive past it. You know, the Selena mural that I did, I knew exactly what I was doing when I was placing it there. So it ended up becoming a very impactful piece for the community as well as, you know, the country and stuff. So I think that's the strongest attribute that mural work has, is that the ability to impact a bunch of people, you know, during a concentrated time and stuff.
Right. And you can just walk up on it.
For sure.
You don't have to go someplace special. You're walking to work and you see it.
Yeah. Galleries are pretty stuffy nowadays. You know, it's very limiting. You know, they're kind of putting you in this white box and stuff. And, you know, I've really found it really sad that how exclusive, you know, gallery work is and stuff. And for me as an artist, you know, I try to make art accessible to everyone and stuff. And I think the Selena piece was a perfect example of how it really communicated with people all across Milwaukee as well as the country.
Well, I think it's also great that you're combining forces here, too, because you've got this wonderful festival of films that introduces the wider community to maybe something they haven't seen before or thought about before. And same thing with the art. And you've kind of put two different disciplines together in an interesting way.
And they're taking that one step further by this poster isn't going to just live on paper or digitally. You know, as Mauricio talked about, it's going to be part of the community and talk about, you know, the commitment and to Cine Latino and to all of the markets that Marcus Theater has, but certainly create that surprise element and that accessibility element that you find, because this mural or this poster is going to live on the exterior of the South Shore Theater, which is, I think, a super exciting part for the community.
When are you painting that?
So I started the painting process of the mural at South Shore Saturday morning, and today's my third day working on it. I spent a couple of hours this morning before the radio station to get some a couple of colors down on the wall, but I should be looking to wrap up the mural this weekend. So anybody could check it out and stuff if they're interested.
And they can come by and see you working on it. Oh, that's cool.
Absolutely.
That's very cool.
Live painting.
Mauricio and Nancy, I want to thank you both so much for coming in. Good luck with the cold weather on finishing your painting outside, Mauricio. But it has been such a pleasure to have you both in the studio.
Likewise. Thanks so much for all you do.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Nancy Hernandez helps organize the Cine Latino Hispanic Film Festival, and mural artist Mauricio Ramirez has created the poster and the permanent mural on the wall of the South Shore Cinema in Oak Creek.
The festival kicks off tonight at the Bistroplex at Southridge and then moves to the South Shore Cinema Thursday through Sunday. There's more information at WUWM.com.
From Hispanic culture to Yiddish art songs and Negro spirituals, all interpreted by a gay African-American Jew. Travel the world with Lake Effect when we return on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. At first blush, you might not imagine any overlap between traditional European Jewish musical forms and African American spirituals. However, bass Anthony Russell proves there is one, and a strong one at that.
Russell, who trained as an opera singer, is African-American, gay, and Jewish. And he'll be here in Milwaukee tonight for a performance called Convergence, along with the klezmer group Voretsky Pass. Ahead of that show, he joined us on the line from his home in Massachusetts. Thanks so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to virtually meet you.
Of course, it's my pleasure to be virtually met.
And I'm looking forward to actually meeting you when you're here in Milwaukee later this week. It's just so exciting that you're going to be here performing in a number of different contexts. But I suppose the music is where we should start, because this is such an interesting mix of musics that your own journey led you to. How did you discover this compatibility between African-American spiritual music and Yiddish music?
Well, I think it really goes back to my days when I was an opera singer. I was an opera singer for about 15 years, and while I was an opera singer, I pretty much avoided the Negro spiritual because it was usually taken for granted that if you are an African-American classical singer, that that would be a part of your repertoire. And I wanted my repertoire to be marked by my own personal choices as opposed to what it was assumed I was going to perform. So I had a knowledge of them, but in a sense it was a knowledge by negation. And eventually I found out about Yiddish art song, specifically classical music that was written in the Yiddish language, mostly in the first half of the 20th century. And in that, I found a genre and narratives and music where I was really able to sort of be myself as a performer, be myself as an interpreter, in a sense to tell stories about myself. And what was interesting was after a relatively short amount of time really trying to learn how to perform this music and how to kind of assimilate to its sounds and its particular styles of performing and interpretation, I was reminded the most of African-American roots music. So I had spent all of this time, you know, learning about Ashkenazi Jewish music, and in a way I was turned to, you know, the music of my own Yerusha, the word in Yiddish, my own heritage. The way it really started was I was learning this song specifically about a student in yeshiva, in kind of a Jewish religious school. And in the song, the student is mournfully kind of reciting the Talmud, and the song asks, like, are you singing it this way, this mournful way that it's bringing tears to my eyes? Are you singing it this way because it's reminding you of home? Is it that you missed your mother, your father, your brother, and your sister? And do you feel like without them, you are a boat without a rudder? And it just felt like this very kind of emotionally open, very vulnerable song, this text. And the thing that it reminded me the most of immediately was sometimes I feel like a motherless child, which we know is kind of a very famous spiritual. And what was interesting is that they were both written in a very similar scale, in a pentatonic scale. And they were both minor keyed, and they were, in a sense, about the same thing, about this kind of separation from one's family and this feeling of loss and just kind of sitting there with it. So in my mind, I like to imagine that there are these, you know, two individuals in the 19th century, both longing after their families, after this connection in the face of the separation. What I started doing was performing a combination of these two songs, the song about this yeshiva bocher, this yeshiva student, and the spiritual, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. And what I would do is I would sing one line from one and then one line from the other. And the response that I got from audiences when I did this was very intense and very positive. And I decided I would try to figure out if there were any more of these songs from these separate traditions that had any kind of affinities between them. And that search has turned into an entire project, which it will be my honor to bring to Wisconsin.
Yes, and I understand there's an album, too. Is that out yet?
No, actually, we're still in the middle of trying to figure out how and when it will be released. But it has been completely recorded. I did that with the amazing Redsky Pass, without whom this project would be absolutely impossible. I was really lucky to encounter the klezmer consort Redsky Pass very early in my career as a performer of music in Yiddish. I was at the Ashkenaz Festival, which is a week-long festival of Jewish culture in Toronto, and I encountered this absolutely amazing consort of players, and there was something about the quality of their playing that immediately caught my ear and my heart. There was just a real amount of passion. They had a real sort of authenticity that I knew I was interacting with, you know, the moment I heard them. They were playing their own compositions, which is informed by a lot of their work and research in the diverse sounds of Jewish music from Hungary and its surrounding environs. So the funny thing is, when I heard them perform for the first time, I went to them and I kind of gushed my general admiration for their playing and for their music, and I found out that they live in Berkeley, which was just the next town over from where I was living at the time, which was Oakland. And basically, because of that very lucky geographical nearness, we started working together. And it was really to them that I was able to realize on a much larger basis what the sound of this project was going to be, what a project that was at once sort of traditional and contemporary African-American in its idioms, but also Jewish and Ashkenazi Jewish in its idioms, like what that would sound like. And I was really lucky in the sense that I was able to draw on their expertise in these kind of two worlds in order to create what the sounds of this project was going to be, what the sounds of convergence were going to be.
In your hand, in your hand, Lord, in your hand, every son and Allah, in your hand.
I've always thought of klezmer as an indigenous Jewish music, very much the way I think of jazz as being African-American in its origins and its roots. And they're both musics that can be written down but often are not, are passed by ear and by sharing songs and tunes. There's a lot of an improvisatory qualities to both. And so it doesn't strike me as something that's particularly odd that those two things for you were able to come together to create something. I'm curious, did you convert to Judaism because of the work you were doing, or had you already done that before you started the research?
I had a lifelong interest in Judaism, in part because I grew up in a religiously affiliated family. On my mother's side, our family basically brought the Church of Christ denomination to an African-American community of Texas. At least that's the family lore. So I had always been very comfortable with the narratives of the Bible, and especially with the narratives of the Hebrew Bible. So when it came time for me to decide to make good on that kind of initial relationship that I had with these texts, it was not a hard decision for me at all. Now, a catalyst for that, of course, was me meeting my husband, who did happen to be a rabbi and still is very much a rabbi. But it wasn't like the idea of creating a deeper connection with Judaism came completely out of nowhere. You know, I had these texts with me for almost the entirety of my life. So I would say I came to Judaism definitely before I ever embarked on a career in Jewish music. I'm just a poor heaven stranger, a traveling through this world of woe. But there's no sickness, toil, nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
Take this music and this convergence and this kind of mix of cultures and musical styles to Europe, where Yiddish began and certainly where klezmer music was born. How did they react to it?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't had too many chances to perform this music in Europe. The times that I have performed in Europe, I've either been performing kind of the straight Yiddish music that I kind of learned at the beginning of my career as a performer of Jewish music, or I've been embarking on a new project that I've been working on called Tzvei Breeder, where I've started writing original songs based on the poetry of Yiddish from the past 100 years or so. And I do that with a collaborator by the name of Dimitri Gaskin, who also lives in the Bay Area and with whom I worked when I lived there. I did actually have a chance to present some pieces from Convergence for a concert that I did with Dimitri Gaskin for a Radical Jewish Culture Festival in Berlin. And once again, the response was intense and very positive. People had never really heard anything like it. If it seems far-fetched to American audiences, you can only imagine what it would seem like to a German audience. I think it was even on some level provocative, and yet people really connected with the music.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful stuff. And I want to take a moment to just say you don't have to be Jewish and you don't have to be African American to like this. I am neither of those things, and I love this stuff. You know, and
well, I can assure you, like, there aren't a whole lot of African-American and Ashkenazi Jewish performers who perform their music thinking that that music is only for their ears. You know, music, as corny as it sounds, and it does sound very corny at this particular point in history, music really is a language that manages to overcome any number of barriers. It kind of allows you into these worlds that otherwise seem closed. It opens up avenues of culture, of ways of being in the world that can seem very distant. And I think African-American and Ashkenazi Jewish music is no exception as far as that's concerned.
Well, and combining them has certainly changed and shaped your life in ways that I'm sure you never imagined.
It's interesting because I think when I started this project, I was younger than I am now. And in the way of the young, I assumed I was basically creating the wheel. So after having done a bit of research, it was both interesting and gratifying to figure out that these connections have existed for a long time. I mean, if you consider the history of American music, if you subtract the contributions of Jews and of African Americans, and even more, the contributions of Jews working with African Americans, you basically don't have a whole lot of music left. The contributions of African Americans and Jews to American popular culture is kind of like the bedrock of what it is. And in that way, I feel like there's always been this sort of historical affinity for this music to be together. You see kind of in the early part of the 20th century, especially in the 1920s, various instances of Jewish performers performing African-American material and African-Americans performing Jewish material. But as a phenomenon, there hasn't been a lot written about it. There is an author named Jeffrey Melnick who's written a book about this particular period and these kinds of convergences. And I've had, you know, the wonderful chance to kind of be in contact with him. But as a historical phenomenon, it's relatively unknown. It's interesting. On one end, you have the Gershwin, right, who are completely kind of conversant in the idiom of jazz, and yet are you know, recent arrivals to the United States as, like, first-generation American. And on the other end, you have Duke Ellington, who is kind of actively using these licks that he's hearing from cantorial recordings of Jewish music. It's always fascinating to just kind of see the directions in which music go and what people do with it when they encounter it. And it's my hope that this project Convergence is as interesting as these kind of historic delvings into the sounds of other cultures.
Well, we're so looking forward to hearing at least some of this. Anthony Russell, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Best of luck with everything. And please stay in touch and keep us informed of new projects and things coming down the line.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you so much for having me.
I will go. I shall go to see what the end is gonna be.
Bass Anthony Russell and the klezmer group Voretsky Pass perform tonight at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. Russell also performs two other shows this week presented by the Stahl Center for Jewish Studies at UWM. You will find a link to more information about them at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.